Jeffrey, you are the one who commissioned this piece. I pretty much know why you did, but let's talk about the story and Gershwin and the inspiration.
In 2017, I actually had the first inklings of how to celebrate the centennial of Rhapsody in Blue in 2024. And I've done so many different commissioning projects, but each one has its own purpose and its own reason for being, not only for the present, but for future pianists to play. And this one seemed really significant because of the centennial of Rhapsody in Blue. But how do you top Rhapsody in Blue? So I thought, why not try to top it, but try to complement it with a living composer and a new piece, but it would have to be a new Rhapsody, so it ties together. So that took a little soul searching, and I guess I was just looking at an American flag, and I thought, with everybody kind of disconnected here, how do we bring them together through music? Well, the one thing that we do share is the American flag. And I thought, well, that's red, white, and blue. So I Googled and looked up Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue. Of course, nothing came up because we would have known about it. And I decided that was the title. And for some reason, that was, sometimes when you search for a title for a piece, it's not something you think about. It chooses you. It's something that comes out of nowhere because it's something that is supposed to be there. I'll never forget when Richard Daniel Port, we were doing a premiere of his piano concerto called Mirrors. And he was holding the piece. We were at a lecture together. He says, I don't know how this piece, I'm looking at this, how did I write this? And I said, maybe the piece was written and you just had to come along and do it. So I do look at music that evolves as it's there, but we just have, like when people say your life is mapped out for you, I think a lot of things just happen because they're supposed to happen. And this thesis was supposed to happen. And back in 2000, I created this 50-state project idea after the Millennium Fantasy of Ellen Tate's Willick. We covered half the country, 25 states with 27 orchestras in the project. And I thought, well, let's do 50 states. And I actually created it, and the notices went to every orchestra in the country. It's called Concerto America. That was the project with Charles Strauss. It was actually Don Pippin, the Pops conductor, who knew Charles, of course, from Broadway. And he said, Charles Strauss was a composer who studied with Nadia Boulanger and Aaron Copland and Arthur Berger. He wrote a piano concerto in the 50s, and then came Bye Bye Birdie and Annie and Born Too Late, the song, and everything else. And I spoke with him, and he agreed to do this. And I was able to raise the funds for him and not ask the orchestras to put in a dime for the composer's fee or the copying costs, maybe just the rentals of the score and parts. And so we had Boston Pops and Honolulu Symphony signed on. Then 9/11 happened. And Charles said he saw the buildings on fire and he rewrote some of the core of the piece, which is quite a powerful moment. That piece really should be out there because it does reflect America at that time. I told him I'm just not going to do 50 states. It just doesn't seem appropriate. And so I let it go. And the piece is there. I have the recording that's private with Boston Pops. It's a wonderful piece. And Boston Globe gave it a great review. And that was Richard Dyer when he was there. And it came COVID. Around, well, it was just before COVID hit. We had no idea. And I thought late 2019, I want to do something for the Gershwin. And 50 states wasn't in mind. And Peter answered the call and took a while. I'll let him explain his side of that. But during COVID, when we had no work and really no prospects of the future because we knew nothing. What would happen. But I did know that the Rhapsody in Blue would come in 2024, 4 years after COVID started. I wanted to take a shot at this. So I started raising the funds, and orchestras started to join with hopes of coming back. And little by little, state by state, it grew. And I thought, maybe it's time to revisit 50 states. And I did. And over the 4 years, it just didn't until this last past January, state number 50 officially joined and said, wherein, and you can share that. So became 50 states somehow. It just took a lot of work, a lot of pushing, a lot of, putting the brakes on the car and then pushing the gas on the car and going back and forth to people. It's the kind of thing where you just feel like a door-to-door salesman, and you're going to get people who slam the door in your face. You'll have people who say, "I'm not ready. Come back next year. Go away and come back tomorrow," like the wizard says. And that's exactly how it evolved, but it took time, which was good. We had time on our sides, and here we are, and we had the premiere nearly a year ago. And I'll let Peter take it from here because his side is wonderful.
Peter, I did that. It's all wonderful. So tell me about it, Peter. When Jeffrey approached you, what were your thoughts?
Well, it was not an immediate yes for me, let's put it that way, because it was very daunting in several respects. It's unusual to have a pianist, in this case, as commissioner, who has such a very, very specific idea of what it is that he wants, and has a title, and has a title that relates to an existing beloved iconic piece of music, and presents that whole idea. This is very different from somebody who says, "I want a piece, period," right? So this was, here's what I want. It's going to be Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue celebration for, this was 4 years ago. So it was 4 years from now, we're going to celebrate Rhapsody in Blue. And I would like a piece to be called Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue. And I would like it to be about the same length as the Gershwin. And I'd like it to be able to be paired with the Gershwin and played alongside it. Although I'd like it to be able to stand on its own. And it should be about the same length, and it should pay homage to it in some way. And I want to try to do it in all 50 states. So, it's like setting the bar extraordinarily high, very, very high. And
Real
I was,
roadmap, though. It's a, you know, this, 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 this,
yes,
this.
but I felt,
With no money to show for it.
it was so daunting. So, I did not accept it right away. I said, maybe this is not going to work. It's a great idea, but wow, that's very ambitious. Maybe there's a better composer, all of that. But we had some conversations, and he did persuade me. And in fact, I had agreed to do it immediately before COVID. We were actually about to make an announcement to say, okay, like he had spent about 2 months convincing me, and then COVID hit. And it was, a terrible, uncertain time, obviously. And I said, "Jeffrey, we can't announce this right now. Like, this is we're going into the unknown here. We have to hold." But in any case, he continued on raising funds through those bleak, first months where everybody was just very confused and cancellations left and right. So he raised the funds, and that obviously was somewhat of an impetus to move forward. But also, we both knew that eventually we will get out of this. Eventually we will come out of COVID, and this will be an exciting project to do. At that point, we didn't know, when that might occur. But I started sketching, et cetera. And, the most important thing for me was I had to find a way to, if you will, pay homage to the Gershwin, or tip my hat to the Gershwin and to that very specific piece of that very specific time in the mid 1920s, to do so in some way that would let audiences enjoy the reference without trying to simply imitate. I said, I can't try to write. There's only one Gershwin. I'm not Gershwin. I could never be Gershwin. But how do I do it in a way that can somehow tip my hat to it and then also reflect this 100-year journey that we've had since then? There's so much optimism and energy in the Gershwin of his time. How can I do that in my time and try to have American energy and optimism in the piece in a way that will sound like me? And if people listen to the piece, they will hear these nods to Gershwin. But for the most part, I think they will hear, an earlier 21st century composer and somebody who clearly is American and has gone on this musical journey. So it was quite difficult. And whereas the Gershwin, according to, legend, was written very quickly, just a matter of a few weeks, of course, was orchestrated by Ferdi Groffé, which made it a collaboration. But mine, I had much more time, and I needed much more time. So I spent nearly 9 months of work to write this piece. Really quite a lot of work. And I really wanted to try to get it right, find the right balance, and find the right material for Jeffrey so that he could, his virtuosity could be on display, which is part of what a piece like this does, but also try to do something that would have something lyrical and beautiful and allow people to have a kind of emotional response, to find the right blend of all of these ingredients in the piece. It was quite difficult, but in the end, I think we finally did get there.
It is a joyful, joyful piece. I mean, from the beginning, it's very uplifting. Jeffrey, when you were talking back and forth with Peter, were you giving him ideas pianistically or no?
What was really nice is as soon as I received the part, I was able to read through and play. It's playable. See, it's like this. You want a pianist in 10, 15, 20, 100 years to be able to open the score and say, oh, I could do this. I mean, if it's too difficult, they're looking at it like, oh, I'm not even going to get started. And that's what happens, especially with newer music, which is like, well, that's just too much. I mean, why would I slave at something that's way too difficult if I could just play Beethoven in three? It's a mindset. And immediately, the pieces and all the commissioned works I've done, they've been like this. It's been really nice. For the most part, I'd say you could be able to almost mind play it and hear it. You're not physically playing, but you look at it, you say it's something you see that is playable. And it's not like, oh, I don't have to start saying, put this here, put that there, that's too hard, that's too awkward, that doesn't fit the left hand. And the only little things I think I may have said is like, oh, that one I'm gonna split up between the hands. So I'm gonna re-finger that to get the maximum up to the top instead of in one hand, or and it took time for me to figure out what's the best distribution of the hands to make that one exactly the way Peter hears it and writes it in his head. So that sometimes, and pianists can always alter that depending on their hands, but I always try to find the right fingering or the distribution between the hands so that it'll suit pianists in the future. So, part of what I'm doing is it's not to compose, but it's recreating, and it's to be able to find ways in music if it needs, most of it didn't need it at all. As like, how does that fit under the hand? And is that going to be awkward for the guy in 2053? So I want to make sure that it's from the very beginning that it's spelled out as clearly as possible from us, from Peter, and that there aren't any questions. Because, I could call Peter and ask him, on that measure 39, beat three, the end of before four, before the pickup, do you look? I can't do that with Beethoven.
No, you can't.
Oh. So we want to make sure that that's really 100% for the future. So the answer to the question, no, I never interfere in the compositional process. It's kind of like the baby in the womb. Just don't bother it. Don't do anything. Just let it grow and let the person who's creating it feed it. I can't do that.
And one thing that was interesting about this process was that, as I say, it was a long process. So between the time Jeffrey commissioned it and we agreed upon it, and the time he actually heard any of it was quite a while. And I went off and did another big project with a London Symphony recording that I had told him was in the works. So that was like a whole year that I devoted to this other project after the initial sketches. Right away, I made a few initial sketches, and then set it aside and went and did this other whole project with other pieces. Came back to it after more than a year with the deadline that we had agreed upon looming, and then really started to jump into it. And I knew it was going to take quite a while, but it took even longer than that. So ultimately, what Jeffrey initially got from me, I wanted to wait until I had significant chunks of the piece. So there were sections that were done, that were either both sketched and orchestrated, or were just sketched in a two piano form. So there were considerable chunks, but there was still a long way to go when I first presented it to him. And so I said, "Here's okay. So here are, I think it was five or six chunks of the piece that I gave to him. It was enough of a torso that I knew that this was going to be a piece, but there were many things still to be figured out, and there were things still to be orchestrated. So here's some of the opening material, and here's some of this bluesy, jazzy stuff, and here's some of these, really cool jazzy runs that are going to sound like you're improvising in your right hand, but you're actually not. You're writing it all. I've written it all out in total detail. And here is some of this bluesy scherzo stuff, and here is some of the big tune, the big lyrical thing, which actually I wrote first. that I felt really good about. And here's just a little tiny bit of what will be the whole ending section, but I have no idea what that's going to be yet. I just have like 4 bars or 8 bars or whatever it was. So we had these chunks, and I gave that to him, and that's where we started. And so, and that was a moment of kind of trepidation where finally this man is going to see and hear where we are. And that was a cool moment because then he responded very strongly. He was excited. It was like opening some of the presents at Christmas, but not all of them. And then we started to, put it together. I started to put it together. But pianistically, I am like half a pianist. So I mean, I played all this material in, but I played it in, a note at a time or a chord at a time, and my software Sibelius plays it back to me. It's still not the same as having a virtuoso pianist actually lay his fingers upon this material and play it for me. But I have a pretty good sense of what is and is not doable. So I think in the end, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say 98, 99% of what I wrote is exactly what's there. There was, 1 to 2% of adjustment, and the adjustment was pretty moderate. It didn't change anything musically. Leave out a note here or alter the distribution of the hands here, but it was nothing where he said, "Oh, that's really, really awkward," or anything like that. So that was fun. And also, I should say that I wrote way more material than than I used in the piece because it was so challenging. And so the piece is about, I think it's 460 something bars of music. It's 17 and a half minutes, and I wrote over 1,100 bars of stuff. So
Really?
I threw out a ton. I threw out a lot of stuff, and I threw out a lot of cool stuff. Pianistically, I went through various jazzy piano kind of material because it's not my thing. It's not what I do, and I wanted to try a bunch of different things. And there were things that were really cool that were, for lack of a better, comparison, kind of Dave Grusin-esque. I thought they were really cool. Love Dave Grusin, but it didn't fit in the piece. And then there were other kinds of bluesy things using blues scales and harmonies and jazzy material that were cool that I just ultimately didn't fit. So you couldn't put everything in one piece. The proportions have to be right, and it has to feel like the right recipe where these things balance each other. And that's almost impossible to describe. You have to feel it. And so it's a lot of trial and error of, how does this work? How do we get from this section to the next section? So there's a ton of material that just didn't go in, which was it lives in a file. And in the old days, you'd say you'd put it in the drawer, right? You'd have the sketching drawer. So we just put it in the file. And so there's just other files on the hard drives. And who knows, that stuff could end up in other pieces.
Well, I think it should be Cool and Blue, Second Rhapsody. I mean, Gerson
I
wrote
was just going to say,
Second
Gershwin's
Rhapsody.
Second Rhapsody. Yeah,
Yeah,
right.
so Cool and Blue. I
There
mean,
you go.
it's so when you finally all got together and started rehearsing, and it premiered about a year ago, correctly, correct?
Little less than a year, yeah.
So the premiere was first, and then the recording after that with the London Symphony.
That's right. So the Utah Symphony agreed to do the premiere. It was a wonderful experience. Jeffrey set all of that up, and it, he has was talking to many, many orchestras simultaneously, but it worked out that Utah wanted to do the premiere, which was great because they were a great orchestra, major orchestra, and they chose to open their summer festival last summer of 2023, June 30th, 2023. So it was opening night of their Deer Valley Music Festival in a gorgeous setting up in the mountains in Park City, and beautiful night and an opportunity for me as the composer to address a large audience, about 3,000 people who are, in a summer setting, seated on lawn chairs and blankets, in a very casual setting, but to tell them that they were the first ones who were going to get to hear this, to make reference to this beautiful setting in the mountains with the stars above us. And I said, and when you get to this lyrical section, I think this is the perfect setting for this. And I mean, I have to say that, it went extremely well, and the audience absolutely loved it. And it was an immediate standing ovation that lasted a long time. And to get people who are sitting on lawn chairs and blankets to actually stand for a brand new piece of music, I mean, it's harder than in a concert hall. Everybody's comfortable, they have their sandwiches, so it was tremendous
Have their
response.
drinks. They have their
And a
drinks.
drink, and a drink. I mean, people just really stood and then really, really cheered for a very long time. It was really exciting. Everybody felt that it was a special moment. And Jeffrey has subsequently played it many times and is playing it many, many times more. But separately from all of that, we were able to line up the London Symphony Orchestra, the arrangement with Naxos Records to distribute it. And so we went and recorded it in London in 1 4-hour session. and in late November of last year. So Jeffrey
Yeah.
had already played it about, I don't know, 14 or 15 times, something like that, in those intervening months. But I had not conducted it at all, and so it was quite a challenging and fun and kind of high pressure moment. So then you've hired the London Symphony Orchestra, Ayr Studios, Ayr Lyndhurst Hall, tremendous hall, and you've got 4 hours with some of the greatest players in the world to go and record this piece. And it was a blast. It was a joy. Jeffrey was great. The LSO was great. Simon Rhodes, the producer engineer, is absolutely world class. And so, we really had the kind of Rolls Royce or Maserati of the recording experience. And in less than 4 hours, we got it all down, and we made what I think will be the definitive recording of it. So it was great fun.
But first of all, the music is truly amazing. I mean, it takes you someplace. It's so nice to hear a piece of music that goes from here to here and it takes you on a journey with the piano and all the musicians. There's not the music that's being written today doesn't really, for my taste, doesn't really do that. This one hits the heartstrings and makes me feel good. So.
Oh, well, thank you. Mission accomplished. Yeah,
I mean, it is. It's very hard. I mean, Peter, you do a lot of American-esque type things that talk about America and where it's going and everything. But I really do think that you guys have just hit the nail on the head with this piece. So a big congratulations.
thank you. Thank
thank
you.
you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes,
So,
you think about Bernstein and Copland and what you Appalachian Spring or West Side Story, whatever it is, it's pieces that it's like going on a vacation, or well, not always, but it takes you somewhere.
right.
It has to take you somewhere that seems familiar. And Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue does that too. And he combines all the elements of all the peoples who come from all over the other parts of the world, Eastern Europe in particular, and Cuba, and he puts that all in the music and fuses it with blues and with ragtime and with his own, homage to Beethoven and Prokofiev, believe it or not, that are in Rhapsody in Blue. And it's interesting that he did for music, American music in 1924, and Peter did this in 2024, reflecting on an America that we know now. Also based on a lot of the music that has evolved since Gershwin. So you get this little jazz combo in there, which was, when I play that section, I always think of Vince Guaraldi and Claude Bowling and well, Oscar Peterson and that kind of small combo setting. But then you get the big sprawling cinematic theme, whereas Gershwin's famous theme of Rhapsody in Blue is more songful. And actually, it was not what he wrote to begin with. He had to change that quickly because when he gave Groffé his basic orchestration to build upon, there was something else in there. But nonetheless, it was songful. And when Peter came to his lyrical theme, it reflected the landscape of America, which we know through our generations through film, this widescreen cinematic. Like this is Cinerama flying over the Grand Canyon or Mount Rushmore or Niagara Falls or mountain scenes. It's just that kind of a setting. So that, like you say, it takes you to many beautiful places in America, and being rhapsodic, which are just pieces sewn together, it works. And that's not an easy thing to do because I mean, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue is also many different themes sewn together, and this piece is similar. Although he does a very subtle, Peter does a very subtle tip of the hat to Gershwin in the use of Charleston. So as soon as you hear the piece, you hear bam bam da 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 da. You hear that subtle reflection of the Charleston, which was prevalent in the 1920s and in Gershwin's music.
Right.
And but he takes it on from there, and it's just really like. Taking over where Gershwin left off in a way, which really makes the piece work. And it just defines a lot of where we're at now. And who knows, maybe in 21, 24, somebody else will write something. Who knows? It'd be interesting to see if that we start a tradition of a centennial tribute to a rhapsodic tribute, but who knows? So, yeah.
But it's a great tribute, and what an ingenious idea to bring something that is so American and celebrate it 100 years later with fabulous piano playing and amazing music written by you, Peter. So, gentlemen, thank you so much. This is greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank
This is great
you.
fun. Great to talk to you again. And we're happy to hear that the recordings are in rotation on WQED. We
They
love
are in rotation at WQED, and I look forward to your next collaboration, you two.
it.
I
Thank you.
appreciate that. Thank you.